When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul. Good to be here.
I hope so, because this is, Brian, this is the 100th time we have done this.
What?
I know, right?
What?
Yes.
I had no idea.
Well, if you want to get technical, it's actually the 101st time we've done this.
Oh.
But the first time we scrapped it, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we did a trial run, which was terrible. So
those first few episodes, I remember being a little rough.
Yeah.
I don't think we knew what to do. We didn't know what to do with this. Like two friends who were like, hey, we read comics. Let's do a podcast.
Exactly. That was to let everyone know we were on the phone one day talking about comic books. And I had the brilliant idea of, hey, let's just record this and see if it does anything. And here we are, 100 episodes later.
My goodness.
I know, right?
So that's it, right? I mean, we've covered the entirety of all comics.
Not even close. Although, there's enough words in what we're covering today to cover the entirety of all comics. Today on the program, we'll be discussing All-Star Comics, specifically the Justice Society of America and all the fun that entails. I will be relying heavily on Brian to lead this conversation because I have a feeling it's going to be a bit sprawling.
Oh, I thought you were going to lead this.
Oh, no. But first, before we get into that, some sad news. A few weeks ago, as the time of this recording, John Romita Sr. has passed away. John Romita Sr. was just a legend in comic books. Just one of the greatest artists in the history of the comics.
Yeah. I mean, he was there at, I don't want to say the beginning of Marvel, but so many iconic panels.
Absolutely. And I'm going to be a little controversial right now. You ready for the controversy?
I'm ready for the controversy.
Ready for the comics?
I am.
I think his Spider-Man is better than Ditko's.
Ooh.
Yes. That's a personal preference, but I grew up reading his Spider-Man, and when I think of Spider-Man, I think of Romita.
I'm kind of the same. Again, it's like the early stages. We've talked about this before, but the early stages of Marvel are kind of tough reads, right? And you know, I mean, Ditko is Ditko, Kirby is Kirby. We could go into all of the great artists, but it was when, like, John Romita was part of the Spider-Man that really engaged me. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And don't get me wrong. I don't want to say that, oh, I hate Ditko. No, Ditko's work is phenomenal. It's just when I was reading comics at that early age, it was Romita's Spider-Man that I read. You know, those, just the Spider-Man suit in the trash can as him walking away. Iconic, that panel.
Yeah,
he was, again, you know, as we've mentioned before, we're old. Mm-hmm. So when I was growing up in the 70s and I was reading Spider-Man and I had so many other titles, John Romita's artwork was what I saw. It was him and Kirby.
Yeah. No, I mean, they were there and they were present for long stretches of time. And I think that also is important, is you have artists who like had like a short run and, you know, like Ditko, where, you know, then they move off to other things. And then you have artists who were there for the long haul.
And that was John Romita Sr. And yeah, so just, you know. He shaped, I think, him along with Kirby, just shaped what Marvel would become.
And shaped my perception of Marvel.
Yes, exactly. So, he'll be missed.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's...
I mean, he was 93, so, you know, that was a good run.
He lived he lived a good life, you know, and a full life, and was able to appreciate in his lifetime how much they meant to, and to see his son also carve out, for good or for ill, depending on how one feels about that, but to see his son also, you know, succeed him and become an iconic illustrator in the medium as well.
Exactly. And Junior has his own
style.
His own style. Yeah. I don't dislike Junior as much as, say, someone else I do a podcast with. But, So John Romita, I mean, 93. So that is sad news, but, long, full life was appreciated during his lifetime as well. So.
And certainly in the pantheon of some of the most influential and important artists out there.
Yep. Best Spider-Man artist ever.
Yeah.
And now we're going to move on to what may be an interesting discussion. So as we're recording a couple episodes of Marvel's Secret Invasion, Disney Plus television show has aired. We can talk briefly about the quality of the show. But the big controversy is the opening credits.
Right.
So the opening credits are created by AI. And during this time of the writer's strike and all the kerfuffle around AI right now, some people had some feelings about that choice.
Well, poor timing.
It is poor timing. Okay, and here's where we get into. We talked about AI a few weeks ago on a previous episode. And conclusion we came to there, or our feelings were, it's an interesting technology if it's done ethically. And I think, at least in my opinion, from what I've read, this was actually done the right way. Okay, so what I've been reading is that the AI generator that they're using was created in-house. So they're not just using, I'm going to say ChatGPT, but that's for words, but you know what I mean. They're not just using one that's on the market. They have their own in-house tool, and they commissioned original artwork to be fed into the generator. So they're not going out and taking someone else's work. They commissioned work, and the artists that created it were paid. So, and you can disagree with me if you like. I see this as like same way you would use an airbrush or Photoshop. You know, it's a tool to be used to create a certain effect that is actually fitting with the series that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of talk about this, and there's a lot of he said, she said, they said, who said, what did someone say, that if creators got paid for it.
And that's my understanding. So,
right.
You know,
if creators got paid for it, then that's great. What did they get paid? Did they get paid the same as if they had created this on their own? I don't know. If they did, great. If they didn't, and they were paid what amounts to minimum wage for this type of work, not so good. Who created it? I don't know. It looks like shit.
I mean, I think it's supposed to look. I think it's supposed to look that way. But you know,
that's fine. But what, like, why would you be proud of creating a thing that looks like crap?
I don't think it looks like crap. But I think it's a very interesting effect from an artistic standpoint. Sure.
And I understand. Like, so the idea of Secret Invasion is that what you're trying to say is the AI is appropriate because thematically it works with the fact that.
Yes, because it's where the show is using, you know, who can you trust? Everything's artificial. Everything's morphing into something else.
But it's not really artificial. I mean, Skrulls are real.
But the identities they create.
Skrulls aren't actually.
Yeah, Skrulls are real, man.
Skrulls are actually real. But in the world that we're viewing, Skrulls exist.
But the identities they create, and then there's
they're lesser because they're taking on. I don't know if I buy it, Paul. I don't know if I buy the argument. I think that if thematically they're saying we're using AI because in this fictional world Skrulls are AI. Well, they're not. They're living beings in this world.
It's about the identity and. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't trust what you see, which is what AI, you know, can you trust that AI is that what you're reading wasn't created by a bot? Can you
trust
that art wasn't created by something else?
But there are other ways to do that, like, say, in the plot of the show, as opposed to using AI as the introductory sequence.
It's a stylistic choice, and you can not like it. That's perfectly fine. But it was. But I okay. I'm sort of like, man, that was interesting. But again, it's just an opening title sequence. Now, the argument, and I think
this
is valid.
It's a third rail that they didn't have to touch, but they decided to touch.
Yes. Now, the argument, and I kind of think this is valid. So an opening animation sequence like that, and someone used the animation for Ms. Marvel, mm-hmm. where you had about 100 people working on that. And in this, there was maybe a dozen. So, yeah, I mean, so using the AI tool, you were able to save on, you know, not hiring as many people.
You're taking work out of somebody's hands at some point.
Right. And I think that's a valid
point that didn't need to be made in the opening sequence, but could have been made in the plot.
And is being made in the plot. But
right. So if it's being made in the plot, why does it need to be?
But that's kind of the whole idea of the opening. That's what an opening sequence does.
Work out of other people's hands.
Yeah. That's what an opening sequence does. It gives you a shorthand to what the plot is going to tell you.
Right.
I mean, again, whether it works for you as, you know, that's valid. That's, you know, it's subjective whether it works or doesn't. Again, I saw it and thought that was interesting. And then I moved on. And then I moved on until I got on Twitter and said, oh, okay. Apparently people aren't moving on.
Yeah. Well, and luckily I'm not on Twitter. So it's, I didn't have to see all that. But it feels lazy to me. And it establishes a baseline.
It establishes a precedent.
And I think that the excuse of, we're just using this to reflect the show. Well, tell the people who didn't get work or didn't get paid well for it that, you know, oh, well, thank you for your service.
Now, we don't know if people got paid well for it or not. We do know that they had a smaller staff. That is for certain.
Right.
But we don't know. We don't know what they got. But people did get paid. And that's the thing. They didn't just go out, use existing art from Marvel and not hire anybody and not pay anybody. They did actually commission this original artwork mm-hmm. to use. So,
but why not use the original artwork? I mean, why go there?
Well, that's just, you know, it was a stylistic choice. Again, you know, there were artists that created this. So that's what they chose to do. I mean, how many works of art would you say, why would you do that? Why did you do that? You know, I can look at anything by Andy Warhol and say, why would you even take the effort to do that?
Right.
Not to shit on Andy Warhol or anything, but
that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah. So again, it was an artistic choice that I can't slight someone for. Again, this is everything that I have read, and you know, I did cursory research into it, and everything I've read so far just said, yes, these were artists that created this particular thing, and they made a choice. Now, if you don't like that choice, fine. Right.
But that choice then leads to the ability to make other choices along the same vein.
Well, if it gets if this does set a precedent where Marvel and Disney just say, oh, look, we did this and we were able to save X amount of dollars. Let's just do it again. And you keep seeing more and more going forward. That's different.
If we excuse it one time, then it's easier to excuse it the next time.
But if it's a one-off, this was done for a particular reason, for a particular show, I think I can forgive it more than, again, you know, I can't slight the artists, but at the same time, I can slight the capitalist influence behind it.
Well, it's all capitalism.
Yeah.
Even in the comic we're about to read today, there it's set up to sell product.
Exactly.
Right. Everything is there to sell product. I mean, we live in a capitalist society where things are generated to make money, which is fine. I like to make money because I like to pay my rent or I like to buy comic books. But how it's done and what it means going forward, I think we don't know yet. But at the same time, now this exists. And it exists, and therefore we will see going forward. Now, James Gunn has said he's not going to be using AI in the DC world, but if the corporate overloads.
Well, that's not too far.
The corporate overloads maybe is better than the corporate overlords. Is somebody going to see this and say, oh, hey, we saved X amount of money here, so let's use this on another project, and then let's use this on another project. I think this is the concern, is things always start small and we can justify it the first time, and therefore we can start justifying it for each additional time.
Well, I think, you know, the model over it at HBO and DC right now is to just make projects and not release them. So avoid that controversy completely.
That's a different issue.
Yeah. And there has been talk of HBO now commissioning AI-generated plot summaries, basically. So using an algorithm to decide what's the next project they're going to do.
Sure, but that's whataboutism. And what we're talking about is, we're talking about this one thing.
Well, no, but that is an AI thing that is going forward. Again, this is just one opening credit sequence that is, mm-hmm. in my mind, is fine. I wasn't blown away by it, but
it's being set as a tentpole, and we'll see where it goes from here.
Okay. So we disagree.
We agree to disagree. Well, no, we don't agree to disagree. You're wrong.
No. If the people were paid.
The sarcasm in the tone was intended.
Yes. If the people were paid and the tool was used as a tool, not as a replacement, I have no problem with that. However, if it is now going to set the precedent where you just don't have to hire artists anymore, that's troubling.
Right.
Hasn't happened yet. So we're all good. We're all good. As of now, we're fine.
Well, I'm not fine. Some people are fine. Some people are not fine. Sorry. Is this a Frank Miller moment?
No. I am not.
The infamous Frank Miller incident of 20, whatever it was.
Yes, early on in the run, almost killed the podcast. But here we are at 100 episodes. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll see where this goes. This is going to be a lot to analyze.
or not a lot at all. It will depend.
We'll see. All right, we'll be right back. We're back. Brian, for our 100th episode, you chose what we're about to talk about.
What is it that we're talking about?
That's a good question. Okay, let's hear what this intro is.
Okay. Maxwell Max Gaines was born in 1894 in New York City. After a few random jobs in various fields, Gaines took a job with Eastern Color Printing as a salesperson. It was there, in 1933, that he came up with the idea of packaging comic strips together into a pamphlet to be used for promotional purposes. Funnies on Parade, made to be given away by Procter & Gamble, was the initial fruit of his idea. This proved to be very popular with the public, and more such items were produced for other corporate companies. The most notable, of course, was Famous Funnies, which ran for 218 issues and is considered by many to be the first true American comic book. In 1938, Gaines, along with Jack Leibovitz, started up All American Publications, which partnered with National Allied Publications to create original content comic books. Gaines eventually sold his interest in All American Comics and formed a new company, Educational Comics, or EC as we know it now. Upon his death, EC was passed on to his son, William Bill Gaines, who became a pioneer figure in the comics world in his own right. One of the flagship comics under the All-American banner was All-Star Comics, a quarterly anthology used to pimp various characters from other titles. Short stories would be followed by a banner advertising other comics that the featured hero would appear in. It was with issue 3 in winter 1940 to 1941 that All-Star Comics made history. Written by Gardner Fox and illustrated by Everett Hibbard, the issue featured the first appearance of the Justice Society of America. featuring the Flash, Hawkman, Dr. Fate, the Atom, Green Lantern, the Spectre, the Sandman, and Hourman. The comic operated in a frame, with a lead story featuring the entire team, followed by stories of the individual characters working solo to solve the initial problem. By the end, the heroes would all come back together and save the world as a group. Neat! The stories are often very silly, of course. We are decades away from grim and gritty, after all. Characters speak in the same voice, lots of biff, bam, pow, fisticuffs, and athletic daring do. Criminals are one note and often fall into racial stereotypes. Many Nazis are punched, which is a good thing. One of the glaring things is the amount of propaganda present in these issues. On the verge and into the beginnings of World War II, several of these comics could have been written by somebody in the State Department or the FBI. But that is the nature of the times and the nascent birth of the medium. And much of this is highly entertaining, goofy, four-color fun. Eventually, in 1947, the anthology aspect was dropped in favor of full stories featuring the entire team acting as one. Perhaps the most important aspect of All-Star Comics, short of being the origin of the superhero super team, was issue 8, which featured a short story tacked on to the end that featured the origin of a character called Wonder Woman. Written by some guy named Charles Mouton, this brief outro proved to be very popular with readers and led to the ongoing adventures of this obscure superhero written by some other guy named William Mouton Marston. How fun! One could even call this wonderful. So, Paul, obviously this was my recommendation. I thought maybe it would be fun to do a old-timey Golden Age comic for our 100th anniversary. What did you think?
Well, first of all, I'm a sucker for these old comics, so it's a lot of fun.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It wasn't what I was expecting. I thought they were going to do like actual Justice Society storylines, but I found it really, really interesting. In fact, I we'll get into this, I guess, but the whole framing aspect.
Yes.
Where each issue has a theme, and then each of the individual members have to have a story revolving around that theme, and then they all come together at the end to solve the problem. I'm using air quotes, solve the problem. I actually think that's a really novel idea. You know.
Well, I mean, and I think it was, you know, we were talking earlier in our topics about, you know, trying to sell product and capitalism. And I mean, this was an anthology. Its very intent was to sell other comics.
Yes. At the end of every individual story, it says, read more of the Spectre in whatever comic, All-Star Comics or not. You know what I mean? Yeah. So they would always plug where you could find the full adventures of whatever character this is. The other fascinating aspect of this to me is to see these proto versions of the characters that we all know and love, with the exception of Our Man. His girlfriend calls him 5 Minute Man. You know what I mean? Yes. Oh, and just real quick.
Well, it's almost like you could have a pill.
Yes.
That could last an hour.
Yes. If he lasts over an hour, please call Dr. Fate.
Please call Dr. Fate or Dr. Midnight.
Dr. Midnight. Exactly.
Probably Dr. Midnight. I think Dr. Fate isn't going to help you very much with the medical problem.
Our Man has, he takes a pill for his powers, so he's like Amphetamine Man.
Well, what's interesting is, I don't want to get into like what happens to the characters later on, but you know, I mean, the character of Our Man, Rex Tyler, it becomes quite tragic.
I did not know that. I don't know the history of Our Man.
Later on, yeah, no, he becomes he's a drug addict.
Makes perfect sense.
That is addressed in later years.
We'll see, and again, this is where I find it really fascinating, because the characters we see here are not what they will become. I mean, wholesale reinvention of the characters like Green Lantern and Flash,
right?
The Atom is totally different. Just to see what they will become or what they will morph into is really amazing. You know?
Yeah. I mean, these are stock at this point, right? I mean, it's, everyone is stock. Even the Sandman is a stock character. You know, the Sandman is one of my very favorite characters, and I don't, I mean the original Wesley Dodds Sandman, not just the Neil Gaiman Sandman. So, you know, I love Wesley Dodds as a character. Like here, I mean, I think I said in my intro, one of the frustrating parts of this comic is they all speak in the same voice. There is no, I mean, Al Pratt, the Atom, gets a little bit of characterization. Obviously, Johnny Thunder, who I did mention in the intro, he's the comic relief. He's the kind of Jimmy Olsen.
Yes, he's the Jimmy Olsen of the group.
But, you know, I mean, let's not even get started on Hawkman's history, which I refuse to ever get into because I can't figure it out myself.
It's so strange, this version of Hawkman, because he's just a guy wearing some wings on his back with a magic belt, which is bizarre. And his mask actually has the full face of a hawk on it. It's really bizarre.
It's like, how do you even see? Yeah. But I mean, there are interesting things. Like, so we get Hawkman, but we also get, we are introduced to Shira, his girlfriend.
Yeah. Here, put these on and stand here and get shot. That's right. What her job is.
Well, let's not even talk about how, well, we can talk about how women are treated in this.
yeah, we will.
But,
yeah.
But you know, I mean, we get these early, you know, like, so we get introduced to Shira, Hawkman's girlfriend at the time. Of course, like I said, like the whole Hawkman history between him and Shira, and we get into Egyptian, and things get batty with Hawkman. But we get, you know, Shira is there at the beginning of this.
Yeah, shockingly.
Diane Belmont is there at the beginning of this with Wesley Dodds. You know, these characters being created, obviously, like Green Lantern is Alan Scott, and, you know, eventually it becomes something else, and, you know, we get the whole...
Yeah, there's no space police aspect of this now. He's just a guy, right, with a magic ring and a lantern.
The original, you know, Green Lantern. What's fun is like seeing these characters represented,
yeah,
in a way, like, let's, you know, in a way that is so far outside what we have become accustomed to in our modern comics reading.
Exactly. I mean, I think the closest we get here is Spectre and Dr. Fate. Maybe not Dr. Fate so much, but Spectre, you can see where his character will evolve.
Right.
He gets darker, but he still has the magic and the shape shifting, and
yeah,
they're all proud to be Americans for sure.
Well, they are very proud to be Americans, where at least they know they're free.
Exactly, because, you know, start with a very low bar.
But I mean, in truth, it's some of this is hard to talk about because a lot of these issues are completely and utterly inconsequential. They are, by their very nature, they are comics from the from 1940 and 1941. A lot of the framing is kind of silly. So, and then the adventures that they have in between the frames are, for our modern reading purposes, very forgettable.
Yes, there's always,
remember, to be honest, I tried to take a lot of notes and then I just gave up because I was like, there's no reason for me to take a note about 10 pages of Hawkman or whoever it is fighting a headless person.
I found that one to be really interesting.
Well, that was kind of fun. Okay. But, you know, just as an example.
No, for me, it was always, oh, there's generic gangster with generic henchmen doing generic plot. And then at the end, it's like, here, have a knuckle sandwich. See, I'm going to get into some fisticuffs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, and again, a lot of the dialogue is very charming for, you know, you go, oh, how quaint. Stuff, yeah,
it's all very quaint. I mean, it's like it's like those old Hollywood films, you know, when they would have somebody announcing something and it would all be in a certain type of voice.
Exactly it's what we call received pronunciation, except it's that New York kind of New England that hey Shay, yeah, and you could just hear that. In fact, there's so many things that, like, at one point, who is it, one of them punches someone else. And it says he KO'd him. Now, KO is short for knockout. So it should be the letter K and the letter O. But it's spelled KAYOED.
Oh, yeah.
You KO'd him. Like, you're spelling out abbreviation.
Well, I don't know. Were they getting paid by the word?
Maybe so, or by the letter.
Let's hope they were, because my God, they must have gotten paid a lot.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
There are a lot of words.
Oh my goodness. There's some panels where you barely have a picture. It's just a whole bunch of words surrounded by a balloon. Mm-hmm. And I find this really fascinating as well. So that there wasn't a consistency in lettering, in how panels were. It's just, you know, you can see just people just learning this. The language of
Wild West of the beginning of comics.
Yeah. Well, the language of comics. And what I mean by that is like how stories are told and like, you know, how the panels flow, how.
Let's bring Scott McCloud into this.
Right. Well, it just, you know, how lettering is done, how word balloons are done, how thought balloons are done, how captions are done. All of this is being worked out. And, you know, it's kind of like watching old silent films where they haven't quite figured out editing yet, they're learning on the fly. So when we watch a movie today, we know how films are supposed to be presented. We understand scene transitions and so forth. And in old silent films, they didn't have that idea yet. And that's what we're looking at with these comics.
Well, and it reminds me a little bit of, you've seen Singing in the Rain.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I mean, classic film, but you know, it's Singing in the Rain is great because it's meta, and the idea, like, so they show, like, you know, it's Gene Kelly, and you know, they're doing the whole where they're transitioning from silent to sound, and you have that all those hilarious scenes of them trying to mic the actors, you know, and the boom mic comes in, or they try to put it in a plant. And I feel like reading this, it's very much like those scenes in Singing in the Rain, where, again, like you said, it's like they're trying to figure out how to make sound work in films. And here in Justice Society, they're trying to figure out how to make comics work on a page.
Yeah. And there's so many times when the characters will turn to us, the readers, and say, what do you think? Don't forget to come back to see the rest of our stories. It's like, that the whole idea of what a comic is and you know, how we're supposed to read a comic, it's all being figured out right now. And it's great. I mean, I love watching that, you know, watching the sausage get made, as it were.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, these are really fun comics.
Yeah, they are. We should say that, you know, we should reinforce that anyway. They're really fun comics.
Vastly entertaining, but you have to pull. It's a weird transition where you're pulling yourself away from what is known into what was.
And you have to put yourself into the mindset of the time frame too, because we're right. This is a country about to go to war, and propaganda is on max right now.
And remember that the audience was different at the time.
Yeah. I mean, these are geared a lot towards kids, to a younger audience. I will give this credit for a few stories in. I was like, wow, this isn't really racist at all. And then all of a sudden a story hits. I'm like, oh, there it is.
You're like, oh God. Yeah. Oh, here we go.
Yeah.
There's one. Well, there's a couple. There are three issues, I think, that I, when reading through this, three out of the eight that we read that I think are interesting. And two of them, what I would say is some political overtures.
Some? Oh my goodness.
The first issue is kind of like, okay, here's this team, here are their silly stories, and here, and then they get back together. It's kind of them gathering, but it's issue four. Do we want to like dive into a couple of the issues?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, we could talk about a couple of the issues. So issue four is the one where I'm really like, holy crow.
Yes.
This is in my intro. I mean, this could have been written by the FBI or the State Department, right?
I don't have evidence of this, but I have a feeling that someone must have been looking this over, because holy cow, to the point where they talk about the FBI and the director is just this fabulous guy. See, we just right. love him so much. It's like, was J. Edgar, you know, proofreading this?
You know, at one point they decide they're going to make the head of the FBI the nameless, faceless head of the FBI, a member of the Justice Society.
Yes, absolutely. An honorary member. Yeah, I have because I wrote down what all the themes are for each issue. Mm-hmm. And for this issue, America, democracy, freedom. They have to go around.
Around the country. Well, it starts off with them, you know, being approached by the head of the FBI, and they give this crazy, you know, they, you know, and it's all about, you know, subversive activities and the fifth column.
Yeah, and there's lots of fifth column in this.
Yeah, and this, I believe, came out, I wrote this down, this came out before the this issue came out before the U.S. entered World War II.
This came out before Pearl Harbor, for sure.
Right before.
Yeah. But the gearing up at that point, it seemed inevitable that we would enter World War II at the time. You know, not to get into a history kind of thing, but the prevailing idea was we need to join the Allies in this war. But there was still a anti-war segment of the population. And of course, Pearl Harbor happened, and that all went out the window. But it is just so fascinating to see, because there's gray shirts. They have each individual member has to infiltrate and stop gray shirts.
Yes, the gray shirts.
I think they must have you know, bleached their brown ones.
But I wrote down a few quotes. So there's hilarious dialogue in all of this. But I wrote down, so they're talking about, you know, the FBI director is, you know, we got to get rid of these subversives in all of these aspects of American society. And of course, it's all talk about free speech and America's about freedom. But then, like, they're all assigned to go suppress free speech. It's the Atom that says, I'm going to read this quote here. I apologize if it sounds canned. I hope I get the job of cleaning up the colleges. I'd love taking a poke at a couple of those dictator-minded professors.
Yeah, God forbid professors should be advocating free speech.
It's almost like 1940 is like 2023.
Oh my God. Well, there's also, at one point, they're talking about how these gray shirts are trying to turn American men into sissies.
Oh, right. Yes, there's a lot of sissy.
Yeah. They're making us weak and turning us into sissies. And we save them all by making them join the army.
Yes, yes, no, there's and it's the Sandman of all people. It's Wesley Dodds, which drives me crazy because of who we know of Wesley Dodds as a character going forward. It's Wesley Dodds that talks them into, like, joining the, if you really want to, like, not be a sissy, yeah, join the army and help, you know. So go get yourself killed, kid.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're obeying blindly, mm-hmm. gray shirts. And he says, well, don't do that. Join the army so that you can obey blindly the American way.
Right.
Yeah. It's like there's a lot of mixed messages in
this. And the jingoism in this one is all over the place.
Oh my God. There's a thing about, you know, they're infiltrating unions and trying to get the unions to strike for no reason.
Right.
And all the good union guys are just like, we don't want to strike. We're getting plenty right now. Yeah.
We're happy to be underpaid.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not defending the opposite side.
I'm not defending Nazis.
We're not defending Nazis, but it's the way the jingoism propaganda works in this, where it's, again, yeah, it's, you know, Green Lantern is protecting the radio from the Nazis.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't want people broadcasting things you might not want to hear.
Right. And it's all framed, of course, because we're protecting America.
Well, exactly. So the fifth column has infiltrated America.
It takes the extreme of, like, sort of the Nazi viewpoint and goes the other extreme of, you know, trying to, you know, we have all these superheroes who are basically trying to do the same thing on the opposite side.
It's interesting what you said about, you know, I'm not trying to defend the other side. Of course not, because they're reacting to Nazi propaganda.
Right.
But the propaganda they're using, I have problems
like
with.
Right. It's like Nazi propaganda.
Yeah. Don't listen to their propaganda. Listen to our propaganda. It's really fascinating. I mean, it is a snapshot in history. It is unfiltered how this country was gearing up for war. And how we were trying to sell that war to everybody, including kids. Because you know that these comics also went out to various soldiers.
Yes.
It's. I'm going to use this word a lot. It's fascinating.
It is. Really, and you know, the frame, of course, is that they're trying to get this one guy, this Fritz Claver. Turns out he's in Toledo, which, to be honest, is someone born and raised in Ohio before escaping. You know, I can kind of see Toledo as being where...
yeah,
We just lost all our Toledo readers or listeners. But
it's interesting. At the end of each individual story, they say, "I'll see you in Toledo."
Right. Yeah. And it's the whole point is, you know, they each individual story, they figure out, oh, there's this guy named Fritz Claver. But at some point, like the Flash sends telegrams to people.
That's so funny. Someone, is it Sandman who comes home? Someone comes home and sees a telegram. Oh, Flash says I should go to Toledo. Yeah, it's amazing. Really fascinating. I mean, and it's no holds barred as far as stereotypes and cliches. I guess, were they cliches back then? They must have been.
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, these cliches existed already in literature.
At least how the gangsters are being...
Right, and in film, I mean, they were definitely...
Yeah,
why, you dirty rat, you know?
Yeah, they'll fill you full of holes like Swiss cheese, see? That's an actual line. Yeah, it's really... I guess we keep saying this. It's a little glimpse... It's interesting to see how things have changed, but a lot of the attitudes still are around.
Right.
Just slightly different.
And they're presented in different mediums and in different ways. But
yeah.
I mean, I think this issue was really fascinating just in how structurally it worked in all of these ideas. And you know, kind of it begs the question of how much control was in the writer's hands and how much control was in, I don't want to say editorial, because editorial at the time was very different than what we think of editorial now, but how much of a heavy hand was being put by outside forces?
Yes, it'd be really interesting to see how much vetting the government had in this. Was there someone who would, a censor board?
Right. You know? Because at this point, comics had started. This wasn't the beginning. This was very early on in the comics. But somebody in government was paying attention to this new media.
Well, this has already been established. It's about 10 years since Superman. Right. Yeah, it's about roughly 10 years since Superman was, you know, introduced. And the popularity of comics was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So by the time we are here, you can see how... The military, the government would say, okay, well, we can get our message out using different avenues. And one of them would be these popular funny books.
Because, you know, they're in the hands of, and it's very interesting because oftentimes popular media is ignored until it becomes extremely popular. But this is a really interesting, there's another one later. I don't know if we want to talk about that now, out of order. And it's the one where they go to Central and South America and Mexico.
Yes, I have written down for the theme, South America, freedom, democracy.
But that one is in, you know, I think I might just jump to that here.
Sure. It doesn't really matter. You could read these out of order and it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, it's so again, it's the same. The FBI director shows up again. This is like six issues later. Which, if it was quarterly, I didn't write down the dates. I mean, we're talking between 1940 and 1942, 43 for all of these.
Right.
But then the JSA is sent. So in issue 9, the JSA is sent to South and Central America and Mexico to bust up. And now this time it's not just Nazis. It's fascists.
Oh, yes. We got the fascists.
Which, of course, they equate as the same thing.
They are. Nazis are fascists.
Right, but the fascist movement and the Nazi movement are sharing similar ideologies, but are also, they're technically separate movements.
Technically. But there's still a lot of Fritzes and hairs in here.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, because they conflate them both as completely the same, and which is even weirder when you get into, you know, the Banana Republic stuff and into the southern parts of the continent. Yeah. So, again, this is the same FBI director, six issues later, 3 years later, is sending them down.
To infiltrate and stop various schemes from the fascists. They never say Nazis, do they? They do say, they have swastikas thrown up every once in a while.
Right, but I think they're still the gray shirts. Some of them are still gray shirts. But again, it's very similar in theme where they're going down. And what's interesting is they're sent to different countries. here, as opposed to different cities in the United States, which they were in the previous one. Some of it's funny when they end up in when Johnny Thunder ends up in Cuba. And yeah. And each of the frames, like, so you have the main frame and then you have the individual stories, but each of the individual stories have a frame where they talk about, like, they give the history of each of these countries.
Yes, they have a little micro history.
Right. And you're reading this going, well, this is great. They're like acknowledging like the sovereignty of these countries and how great these countries are with their culture and whatever. And then they get there and then it's just racial stereotype after racial stereotype after racial stereotype.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of dialogue in accented, you know.
Yeah.
Like really thick accents. And it's just like some of it was just to be shaken. That was this is another one. It's like, oh, yeah, here's the racism. There it is.
But again, it's kind of the same thing. And we don't have to go into each individual one. My favorite, though, is when Johnny Thunder ends up in Cuba and it talks about how wonderful Cuba and a bastion of freedom. And it's like, ooh, the State Department will change their tune on that in a couple decades.
There's also, I think it's either in Argentina or Chile, where at the end an official just says, and we agree with the United States and we will be your allies forever and we will always follow what you say. It was like, and nothing ever changed in South America ever again.
Yeah. I this issue is actually one of the more entertaining. Like, it's horrible. I am not excusing, but at the same time, how they treat these countries versus what we know now and how we treat these countries now, it's not funny.
No. Well, the attitude is that, you know, we're the grown-ups going in to save the kids. And that's the attitude that is portrayed here. We're helping you because you can't help yourselves, kind of a thing. And again, snapshot in time, which things will change quite radically in about a decade.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and so this is kind of I view this one as kind of a piece to the fourth issue. These are the two primary propaganda issues.
Absolutely. Oh, there's something I was thinking about on this one. At this time and into the 50s, you know, South America was seen as, you know, it was really exotic and it was really popular. Exactly. Just think of Rico Ricardo and
all the films in Hollywood would have people going to
Three Caballeros. You know, Disney was doing
South American countries, and you know, it was the music was you had a Lounge and Exotica coming in to
who's the Fruit on the Head?
Oh, Carmen Miranda.
Carmen Miranda. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was just so interesting that Latin American culture. Yeah. Again, I'm using quotes. Latin American culture was so huge at this time.
And that lasted for a while. That lasted from the 40s, you know, I think it kind of started even earlier and into the 50s, just in popular culture in general.
Oh, yeah. Like Cuban music especially was just everywhere at that time. Yeah.
And the great thing is it's all great music. Luckily, we still have all that great music, but, you know, the way we treated these countries and the way that they're treated in this comic is it's treated as the exotic other.
Exactly. Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's the white men, the white American men coming to save.
In the Spectre's case, really white.
Really white. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's about as white as it gets. There is some interesting. Well, I have written down there's one where there's a tank that has a drill on it, and they keep calling it the boring tank. I don't think it's that boring. I think it's really interesting.
I don't think I would be bored at all if that was coming after me. I would be pretty excitable, mostly with fear.
Exactly. But there's some good stuff with the Spectre, you know, in giant size, ripping planes from the sky. You could see where Alan Moore would get some ideas.
Yes, you can.
Yes. We can make fun of these things, and it's very interesting. But many, many writers and artists would be reading this as a kid, and you could see where these ideas will go or the influences that they have.
Well, and again, like, it's some of the action sequences, not just in this but in this entire thing, there's some wacky ass shit going on, you know. At one point the JSA goes 500 years into the future
in the year 2442
to solve some kind of what is it to have a dome over the United, so a missile or an air defense thing. Obviously, this carries over into Legion of Superheroes. This carries over into all kinds of, you know, comics that chose to like that had this like future traveling ideas. This comes from not just this comic, it comes from other comics at the time. Yeah. But certainly the creators of those were reading the JSA comic where they traveled 500 years into the future.
Absolutely. I mean, just Geoff Johns alone could have mined so much information from this. Yeah, it's fascinating to see, you know, you said it yourself. It's Wild West. Everything's getting thrown at the wall. Yes, there's a lot of cliched writing. Yes, it's a lot of recycled old ideas, but kind of twisting them into, you know, trying something new. No, it's really interesting to see where this will evolve, what this will become. Words are not are failing me right now. Sorry.
You know, there's an issue where issue 7 is interesting. I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but it's fun because the JSA decides that they need to monetize so that they can raise money
for the war orphans.
For the war orphan effort.
Or warfans.
The war. We're both going to hell. Each of the members of the JSA goes out to earn $100,000 or to make $100,000. And I loved reading this because I would like to make $100,000 too. In a day. But the best part to me of that was, so, you know, you have this kind of social justice thing going on as well. But when like Wesley Dodds, so this is also the issue where Batman and Superman show up. At the end, Deus Ex Machina, whatever you want to call it, to provide the last of the money to help them out. But they all talk about earning this money and like trying to get it. But two of the people involved, Batman and Sandman, are billionaires.
Billionaires, exactly.
It's like, why is Wesley Dodds running around trying to get like $100,000?
Yeah, he could say, well, let me just write a check. There you go.
You know, why is Batman going out trying to, or, you know, find $100,000? He's got it.
And I love the fact that he brings all the money in a bag with a dollar sign on. Yeah. Because that's how you carry money.
But this one is like, it's one of those weird ones where it's like, it's just so goofy. Everything about it is goofy. Yeah. Everything they do to earn this money is goofy. It doesn't make any sense. And I laughed like hell reading the whole thing and enjoyed myself immensely.
Absolutely. This was my favorite of Johnny Thunder's stories. We should explain. I guess maybe most people won't know who Johnny Thunder is. He's a Jimmy Olsen type character who has a lightning bolt. A lightning bolt. Yeah. A thunderbolt genie. It's a genie, basically, shaped like a lightning bolt that he has to say the magic words. Say you. C-E-I. I didn't write it down. How do you spell it?
We don't want to get in the whole history. There is a whole history of Johnny Thunder and Thunderbolt, and they are characters that have carried on in the DC universe.
It's so silly, though. I mean, Johnny Thunder just does not know how his powers work.
He doesn't know the secret word that makes the genie appear to grant all of his wishes.
Yes. So he has to keep saying things like, say, you want to go out to the store? He said the magic word. So now he has an hour of, and everything is in hour increments, not just hour, man. Everything is in hour increments, which I find fascinating as well. But Johnny Thunder, in order to make money, he has a little bit of money. So he's going to do it the American way. He's going to make $1 million from peanuts. And he literally buys peanuts to try to sell in the street. And then he tries to sell umbrellas. He's trying all these ways to try to sell things, which he can't. Because
he buys ice cream and then it snows.
Exactly. So everything's falling apart. He has the worst luck. And then he makes a wish at the end. I wish Batman and the Flash and Superman would show up and just bring me money. And they do.
Because he had said, say you. No, the every part of all of the John, I mean, he's the comic relief. Like one of my favorites with him is the one where they keep trying to find him. It's his initiation. So the frame is that they're initiating Johnny Thunders into the JSA. So whenever they go to like help him as he's trying to complete this task, he keeps disappearing into some wacky other adventure that the next JSA member gets drug into, but then he disappears again. It's this running gag, and it's funny.
It is funny. I called the theme on that one hazing, because they get him to try to you need to go capture this criminal who's apparently just some old guy who publishes his own newspapers claiming that he's, and it's like,
the Dr. criminal's name is Killer McPansy.
Killer McPansy. That's the
Killer
name.
Killer McPansy.
Oh, 1942. At one point, these counterfeiters try to use Killer McPansy's printing press to make their own money. But it's so funny, just like all these dollar bills, all these bills flying out a window. And you have a passerby say, oh, look at all the money. And he picks it up and goes like, this is counterfeit and it's not very good. So he throws it away. So if it had been very good, would that guy have just kept the counterfeit money?
I would guess so. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. These guys should be ashamed of themselves for making such bad counterfeiting.
But this is the segment where it's the Flash is involved. And so in order to solve the crime, the Flash just comes in and it's super speed, prints all this money so it fills up the house.
Right. Well, oh, and that's it. I have a note here. So in the very first one, in the very first segment of this story, Johnny gets put into a burlap sack and thrown into the ocean, which he summons right. Flash to come and save him. But Flash can't find him, so he doesn't do anything. Flash just leaves Johnny to drown. Like, I found something else to do.
And I think then it goes on to the next one, and Johnny's still drowning.
Exactly. Meanwhile, Johnny's still underwater in a burlap sack. And Flash never comes back.
No, he never does.
Yeah, he's just like, I guess Johnny, c'est la vie.
Okay. I mean, but that's the whole issue is like, it's everybody's just sort of like, well, he disappeared again. I guess he'll be all right. This is the fun part of this comic. Like, we talked about some of the itchy stuff. This is what all these issues are doing. I mean, it's just, and all of the Johnny Thunder stuff is funny. But
it's really funny.
It brings me to probably, I don't know if this is my favorite. It's hard to say for certain what is one's favorite. But so this it's issue 5. So the JSA is bored.
Yes, because crime has been solved.
Crime has been solved. You know, they're just, what do we do?
No, they're just bored. They have nothing to do. Well, there's a criminal mastermind, Mr. X, who controls all the racketeering in the entire city.
Yes.
Not the entire country. And he puts out a hit. Each little criminal racketeering organization has to go out and find an individual member of the JSA and take him out.
But we don't see Mr. X.
Or do we?
Or do we?
But there's a running gag throughout in each of the stories. A little unassuming fella.
Right, Groucho Marx.
Basically, yes. Just keeps showing up and bumping into somebody or tipping his hat and right. just saying, excuse me, you know. And it's in the strangest places.
About that.
Yeah. Is it he shows up under, is it Flash's bed?
Yeah, at one point he's under somebody's bed.
And he's like, well, that's odd. Yeah, no, a man under your bed? That's more than just odd.
What is fascinating to me is, you know, from the get-go, from the first time we see him, you and I reading this, and probably anybody now, are immediately like, oh, that's Mr. X.
Exactly. Yeah.
Here is Mr. X. My question is, if you're reading this in 1941...
Was it just something silly and... You know, would you have put that together?
To, like, insult the intelligence of the readers at the time, because that's not fair and not accurate. But that device maybe was new, right? So
this is what I was talking about before. It was like
with this sort of thing.
We know the language of comics. We know how these stories are put together. We've been reading
we know
them.
The language of narrative as it's developed over the years.
Exactly. Well, I mean, but yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't figure out who Kaiser Sose was until the end, but...
Yeah, but we've been telling stories like this for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, somewhat new for comics. And it's very, very interesting. And I love at the end where they all, you know, they all each have their own individual stories. They've all bumped into this hat-tipping fella.
They defeated the criminals that are trying to take them out.
Here's this Mr. X shows up. We don't know it's Mr. X yet. This little hat tipping fella shows up and they all say, hey, I met that guy. And Flash says, he was the fella under my bed. Yeah, that should have tipped you off.
At that point, I would have been looking at him going, because Fleisch was the first story. It's like, man, if you just realized that a guy under your bed is weird, you could have solved it from the get-go.
Exactly. But it's hilarious that Mr. X just says, this is amazing.
He just kind of gives himself up.
He says, well, there's nothing I can do. You solved all the racketeering in the entire city. Now I'm just going to turn myself in and live off the state. Yeah, he's gonna go to prison because that's easier, and I could just live off the state. And
like, right. Well, it's easier than trying to start up another racketeering.
Yeah, but they're treating prison as if it's welfare. I mean, good Lord.
One of the other great things in this, and I wish I had taken down more notes on some of these things, but like the Sandman portion where Diane Belmont is captured. She's captured by the Kidnappers Union.
I wrote that down. I have it with exclamation points. Kidnappers have a union?
They're literally calling themselves the Kidnappers Union.
Do they have to pay dues?
I would assume so. I mean, well, the money's probably shared around.
Who do you strike when you strike at the Kidnappers Union?
This is one of those issues that I think is so great, and it's so much fun. Like, each of the individual heroes, each of their stories has really funny moments and has really interesting moments. We're not going to bore people by going into it, but it is structurally so good.
Yes.
And so well done. It's probably of the issues that we read issues 3 through 10, of the issues we read, this to me is like so on point in almost every way, shape, and form. Like, I feel like, to me, this is like a perfect comic.
I agree. I like this one a lot.
Everything working together just really...
No, I mean, the characterizations are all on point, at least for who they are at this time. There's actually some, I don't want to say nuance, that's not the right word. It's fun, it's interesting. It would have been interesting to see where this would have gone without having the all the war propaganda. So if there's more issues like this one, like I said before, I really like this structure, actually. I like this idea, like the each individual story, which culminates in the team getting together to solve the big overarching problem.
And this eventually ended, this format ended, I think I wrote like 1947, around that time is when then it just became straight up just the JSA. And of course, eventually we got another team called the JLA, and then eventually we got another team called the Avengers. And my knowledge of the history of world comics is not fantastic. I feel like this is the first superhero team, or at least the first one of consequence.
I would say that it's the first one that this led to other great, bigger and better things.
But even still, the way the format worked, they weren't really like a superhero team in the way we think of it now.
They all just kind of come in and sit around a table. Yeah.
But it's so iconic. I mean, that the cover for issue 3.
Yeah. How many times have that been parodied or homaged?
To me, it's one of the most important covers in comics, not necessarily in its artistry, but in what it represented for the future of comics.
Could you imagine being, you know, 10 years old, going to the newsstand and seeing a comic with all your favorite heroes sitting around a table and just going like, oh no, they're all in this. This is amazing.
And we take that for granted now, because now we just sit around and bitch about whoever's been chosen to be in our favorite superhero team, whether it be the Justice League, whether it be the Avengers. But at the time, like you said, that's what you got. That was the first time you saw this.
That's I try to put myself into that time period, in that mental state of like, this would have been mind blowing. Yeah. And we take it for granted now. This was cool stuff.
I think it's one of the things I wanted to mention as we're winding down a little bit, because I think we've kind of, I did want to bring up the fact that this was written by Gardner Fox. The art is serviceable. I mentioned one of the artists. There's a couple others, but the artists don't.
It's fine.
After the AI conversation, I'm now saying that the artists don't matter. But the important thing here is it's Gardner Fox. And Gardner Fox has to be, whether he is a good writer or not, can be debated by history forever. But he wrote over 4,000 comic book stories. He is a co-creator of Barbara Gordon. He's a co-creator of The Flash. He's a co-creator of Zatanna. He's a co-creator of Sandman. And he also created the multiverse in The Flash of Two Worlds.
Iconic in the comic book world.
So it needs to be mentioned, as much as we're making fun of the writing in some ways and the plotting or whatever, this guy is such a giant. Yeah. Not in his ability to write dialogue or whatever, in the creations that he made. I mean, my goodness.
He came up with some goofy stuff. We gotta come, you gotta give him credit for that. Yeah, like I said, iconic in the industry. And the things that Gardner Fox was doing now, at the time of this, of these comics, it would go on to influence so much more.
Well, and again, just The Flash of Two Worlds.
Exactly.
Holy crow.
Yeah.
So I want to give a lot of credit. I probably should have led with the appreciation of Gardner Fox, but I also wanted to give credit to Charles Mouton, or whatever it is.
We should throw that in there. She wasn't technically part of the JSA just yet, but Wonder Woman makes an appearance as sort of a backup strip. Almost like a throwaway.
It's a backup strip. They were testing to see if anybody would be interested in this particular character. As history has shown, people were.
Absolutely.
The fact that the origin of Wonder Woman is a backup at the tail end of issue 8.
Reading that first backup strip, so much of her origin and storyline is right there.
And a lot of it is she's not as bad as Hawkman in terms of the origin story changing like crazy.
Right.
Now there's been fiddling with her origin story.
Oh yeah, I mean it's evolved over time but all of them have, yeah.
But most of the pertinent aspects are right there.
Yes.
Issue 8 of All-Star Comics, it's Wonder Woman.
Yeah, there she is, fully formed.
Fully formed with a great story, probably the best writing in all of the issues we read.
Yeah. Probably the most, at least for the time, the most inclusive and forward thinking.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really feel tied up in the story. I didn't feel as if I was bound to it. Are my jokes falling flat?
No, I love it. I love it. I think it's great. But I'm a masochist for that sort of thing.
Well, I don't mean to dominate the conversation.
Oh, it's good stuff. It is. It's really amazing to see the origins of these things. You know, just as a historical anomaly, this is really amazing to read. You can see the origins of what will come later, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and when you read comics from this period, it's not just JSA. It's like all comics from this period have the same sort of narrative issues. And this is where it started. This is where everything that we as comic book readers love, this is where it came from. And you mentioned before, you know, Alan Moore and Jeff Johns and whoever else, everybody was paying attention. If they hadn't been born yet and weren't reading the JSA in 1940, they were reading the JSA in 1965, who the writer for the JSA in 1965 had read the 1940. So it all collapses, it all expands. We're not collapsing, we're expanding. Every influence in this stuff is, it's there. I think having a sense of the history of where the comics we most love came from, I think it's really fun to read this stuff. It's hard to read this stuff sometimes. Like you said, it's wordy. It doesn't make sense. There are issues with social things that we don't necessarily recognize today. You know, it's like reading The Spirit or Little Nemo in Slumberland, or like all of these things, the Yellow Kid, the things that even came before this. But knowing where it came from and seeing the influence, I hadn't read these maybe once, but I had a hell of a fun time reading these, even though I maybe skipped over some of that dialogue.
Yeah, I might have done the same. No, I agree. it's great to see where it all came from, and you can see the beginnings and how that this will change and evolve and become the art form that we really love. I mean, this is the beginning of it, and writers and artists, they're learning how to do this, and it's really again, there are some problematic things in it, but if you can put yourself in the mindset of the time it was written, maybe not make excuses for, but have understanding of.
We don't even have to, there doesn't even have to, we can disagree strongly or be repulsed by certain things. JSA is not the worst offender.
Oh, no. No.
Like by any stretch of the imagination. But that exists. But also things that aren't that exist in this as well. And so.
But yeah, so thanks for recommending this. I think this was a fine recommendation for 100. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yes. Do you have a recommendation for us for next time?
I don't. But someone else does. Yes.
What?
So next time on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, we will be doing a listener request. This is coming from Emily, one of our new listeners, actually. And she has Hello, Emily. She has requested that we do Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles The Last Ronin.
Huh.
Yes. So this is from 2022. It is written by Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird, who are the...
Oh, yeah, wow.
Yes. So this is the original AG. Creators of the TMNT. So the original team, and they... and this is a more modern take, I guess. Actually, it's a future take. So it's set in a future apocalyptic world. I have not read this before. It'll be a first time for me.
Well, we had talked about doing, at some point, old school Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So it's kind of great that we have the original creators on what we're about to read.
Yes, I think I'm actually really looking forward to this. And thank you, Emily, for requesting this. And we'll talk more about it next time. All right. So that's it. Listen to the end tag. Learn how to get connected with us. Leave comments and send us your feedback. Let us know what you think of All-Star Comics or anything, really. Just, you know, how do you like the rain? There's lots of rain recently. So until next time on the Collected Edition, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?